have Alejandro Batista for 15 minutes, presenting, correct me if I'm wrong, Linode and Beef. I don't know if I spelled that. I said that right. Okay. Yep. Take it away.
Thanks. Let's go ahead and share my screen. Okay. So the first part is going to be recorded because I did like half and half. And then the second part, I'll do live and go from there. Can you guys hear that? Sorry, I should ask first.
Oh no, you know what? Unshare your screen, and then when you click share, there'll be a little thing on top that says include computer sound. Click on that. When that drop menu comes down.
Gotcha. Let's see. Hi everyone, my name is Alejandro Batista, and today I'll be covering topics of Linode and how to use the Beef tool in Linux. So this presentation will be split into two portions, one being the setup of the Linode server and the second the live attack. So the objectives of this presentation are to launch a web attack against a target's browser with the implementation of the tool called Beef. And then we'll use Linode to launch our cloud platform in order to deploy the tool. But first, I wanted to cover what Linode is, right? Linode helps simplify cloud infrastructures with Linux virtual machines to deploy, develop, and scale applications. In this case, it will help support a Linux server to deploy Beef onto other hosts. Just to highlight the setup of the Linode server, first we're going to navigate to linode.com. And then once inside, we click Create Linode and then Create Linode. Next, we want to go to Marketplace. It has different applications in there, but in this instance, we're going to select Beef, simply clicking the option. And then we'll go to the next slide. Okay, so on this portion, we need to select the Linode options. For example, creating a Beef password, select an email that we're going to use, and creating a sudo username. In addition, we're going to create a sudo password. We're going to need that later as soon as we launch the Beef tool right through the Linux terminal. Okay, so we need to change a couple more settings. One being the region. We want to select the closest region to you. In this case, I selected Fremont, California. From there, I selected the shared CPU option. And then within there, you're going to select the plan. In this case, I selected the Linode 2 GB plan. It's only $10 a month in order to launch their services. From there, we want to establish a Linode label. You can create whatever name you're going to use. And then you're going to add a password to the label that you created. I kept all the passwords the same just so it won't cause confusion later on when I do launch the server. Another thing too, on the next slide, I added a video from a network check to kind of explain the process of the setup of the server.
Okay, step one, let's get our Linux server set up. So if you haven't already, head out to linode.com/networkchuck and either set up a new account or get signed in. And once you're there, let's click on Create at the top left. and click on Linode, because we're creating a Linode. Now from here, things kind of get stupid easy. We're going to go to the Marketplace tab right here. It's going to do all the work for us. Check it out. And we're going to search for beef. And it's right here. Using the marketplace, beef will just come pre-installed on a server that we launch. We don't have to worry about it. So select that, and then we'll scroll down just a bit to add some settings for some config. Here, we'll have our beef options, and the first thing we'll do is set up our beef account user password. I don't know why I said it like that. So we'll just put in something for yourself. And then just below that, put in an email address. This can be any email address. And really, I'm not sure it's used for this installation. It's just required, so you have to put something in there. Anyways, let's continue. Okay, next, and this is just good practice, best practice. We'll create a limited pseudo user to be created for the Linode. So just create whatever user account and then create a password for that user. Everything else is optional, but just pointing out here real quick, Linode will help you set up a domain for this so you can go a little bit crazy. But anyways, it'll do some cool stuff by default. So don't worry about that. So let's scroll down and do a few more things. First, our region, where are we gonna put this thing? Put it somewhere close to you. I'm in Dallas. Next, we'll select our Linode plan. I like my shared CPU because they're cheaper, and I'll choose the cheapest option, Linode 1 GB, $5 a month. So even if you're not getting this for free, that's as much as you're going to be charged for this month. And then we're almost done. We have to label our box real quick. I'll name mine Attack Beef, and then a password from our root user. And that is pretty much it. We'll go ahead and click on Create Linode, and that sucker's going to bake, and we're going to take... Okay, step one.
Okay, so before we begin our live attack, I just wanted to highlight this last point regarding the server setup. Once you hit create, it's going to hang on provisioning for 5 to 10 minutes. Then you'll see it turn green, as shown on the screenshot on the right. That's when you'll know that the server is operational. From there, you can just grab the SSH key, the root name, and IP addresses, and then use that in your Kali terminal, which I'll show next live. Okay, so those are some of the references that I got the information from. Then I'll just go in here. So this is a server that I created from using those steps. So we'll just go ahead and power it on. Give it like a minute and then it should boot on. Then I'll be able to launch the Kali VM I had set up. Because I can log in here. Okay, so now that it's running, I opened up two VMs just so I can test the attack on. So the left one's going to be the Kali VM that I set up, and then the right's going to be the Windows VM. So what I did, I created two emails to create like a scenario of a phishing attack. So on the left, I created a template with the link, and I'll show you here shortly. But first, we're going to go in here, use the root that was populated in the server. We're going to copy this. Then we'll go back to our Kali VM. We're going to sign in. So we're going to use that password that we created earlier. Okay, so now that we're in, we just run the cat command. So cat. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to grab this link here and just open it. It should take us right to our beef page. Now, the username you can change, but I left it as beef. And then the password, you can use the same password we used to create within that Linode. Okay. All right. So it's important to like read through this because sometimes when you hook a browser, these will be on and off, meaning the browser that you hook, some of the commands you won't be able to run if they're shaded off. If they're green, then you should be able to use them on the target. And then the links here. So we're going to copy this link here, the advanced version. And in theory, right, like when you create the template for the phishing attack, this link here actually was the link from here. What I did was I right-clicked it, changed the format of the link to resemble a real link. So when it goes to the person that you're attacking, let's see, they won't know the difference, right? Because they look at it at first glance. Then they click the link. Okay, then you should have control of their browser now, right? You'll see it populate over here. Okay. By simply clicking the link, you'll have all the information on the target's computer shown here. You can also see the logs of when they log on and log off. Commands, you can run commands as well, which I'll show here. Let's see, which one do I want to use? This one. Then we just hit execute, and it should populate on this end. Guess it didn't pick it up. Oh, there we go. See on the right hand side, you'll see the alert that we sent from the attack VM to the target VM. Let's see, we can run other commands as well. Social engineering attacks. We can send a Google phish attack to the target. Up there we go. So what it does, it in turn gives the target a fake website where they think that they're logging in. And what it does, it tricks them. Then on this side, you just click the last command that you set to the target. And you can see the username and the password that I entered, right? Like it picks up the credentials from just simply clicking that link that they got initially. Let's see. Other things we can use, like a redirect link or even ping sweeps, we could do that as well through the framework here. Let's see. Then it'll redirect the browser, whatever you send the target to. That's pretty much the concept I had. It was just more so setting up the server to get the Beef tool going. That way I can hook a browser to see if I was able to do that. And that's pretty much it. I'm not sure if anybody has any questions. Yes, let's see. Oh, sorry. I guess nobody has questions. I guess that's it for me.
Good stuff. Pretty cool stuff. I like how you can just take it over and then it sends alerts out to the browser saying you've been hacked.
The crazy thing is, in the process of like setting up the two fake emails, and when I sent the original link to myself, I'm not sure if I picked up like somebody that was looking at my network, but like they clicked the link and somehow I got control of their browser in turn.
I was trying to hack myself, but instead I hacked you.
Yeah, it was that. So I was trying to figure that part out. So I'm not sure if it was like a glitch or something. But yeah, that's pretty
Cool
much it.
stuff. All right. Well, up next we have a Noah Hansen with OPN Sense Firewall.
Yep, so let me get my screen shared here. Cool, see my screen?
Just remember if you're gonna share any kind of videos or internet, share with sound or with
Yep,
audio on it.
we are good. All right, my presentation is on OpenSense Firewall. So OpenSense, I'm sure a lot of people have heard of pfSense. It's just an open source next-gen firewall. It's created by the same company that made pfSense. There was just a group of people within that company that kind of had different a different creative direction that they wanted to go with OpenSense, so they split off and made this. I figured instead of just telling you a bunch of facts about it, I would show you how to set it up in a VM so you can play with it on your own. Next gen firewalls are kind of becoming the new thing, so they're good to have on your resume if you're looking to get into IT, system admin or SOC analyst or really any part of it. So the first part, we're just gonna head over to the OpenSense site to get our ISO file. So it has a system architecture here. They're only doing AMD 64 right now. Hopefully they'll update it to add some more later down the road. And then they have a description of all of the different ways you can download the image for VMs. We're gonna use the DVD option to get the ISO. And for mirror location, this sometimes defaults to weird places like the Netherlands. So you just wanna make sure that you're picking the closest server to you. And I already have it downloaded, so you don't have to sit and watch me do it. And to install it, I found that it works better on VirtualBox. I personally prefer VMware, but it can have some weird issues with it. So we're just going to create a new one. Call it OpenSense Masterclass. And for the type, we want to pick BSD. And 64-bit memory. The website is going to tell you 1 gig of RAM minimum. Runs really terribly, anything under 4, once you start adding all of the plugins and extra capabilities to it. So I always do 4. And virtual hard disk is fine. VDI is fine. And dynamically allocated is fine. I like to go up to 32 gigs for this as well, because some of the updates and stuff can take up a lot of space. And press create. And here, since we're doing a firewall, we're going to want internet access, but we also want separate adapters for our LAN interfaces. So if you head to Host Network Manager, we just want to make sure we have at least one host-only Ethernet adapter. And next-gen firewalls can do DHCP, so I just unenable that there. And in the settings of the VM that you created, go to Network. Also, we'll set one to the bridged adapter with your host machine. This is going to give us the internet access for your WAN interface. And on a separate adapter, I do the host only for the LAN. And it's also a good idea to just hit advanced and kind of take note of the MAC address of the adapters. So I'm just going to pull up this. I copy the MAC address down for the bridged adapter and just mark that as my WAN. And I copy my host-only adapter for my LAN. And last but not least, we have to hit settings and go to storage. And that ISO file that we downloaded, we want to insert that into our optical disk drive. There's my ISO. And we can press OK and start it up. So basically, the difference between a next-gen firewall and a regular firewall, it's just next-gen has extra capabilities. You can add plugins, you can do IDS, IPS, DHCP, antivirus, and things like that. And you can manage VLANs and stuff within it as well. So just give this a second to start up. And this is kind of the same as like a computer with the Windows CD that you install the operating system on. So we're just booting from the disk right now. So we're going to work on getting it configured so that we can boot it from the actual VM itself without having to have that ISO inserted. So this is asking for a configuration import. We don't have a configuration yet because this is new. So we can just leave it blank and press enter. And this is going to move on to interface assignments. And for now, we can skip lags, we can skip VLANs, you can set that up in the GUI or in the command line later on. And this is where it comes in handy to mark the MAC addresses, especially if you're doing more than just one LAN interface. It can be kind of confusing just looking at the numbers here. So I just see that my WAN interface ended in 8414. And I just matched that up. It looks like that's EM0. So for the WAN interface, we're going to assign that to EM0. And for the LAN interface, EM1. And this is asking if we want to add any extra interfaces, and we can just leave that blank for now. And proceed. So this happens pretty quick. It's just turning on all the interfaces and making sure everything's assigned correctly. All right. And now to get it installed on the VM itself, we have to use the installer login, basically. So the default username is installer, and the default password is just OpenSense. And this is going to bring up the installer. We can continue with the default key map. That's fine. UFS is fine. And then this is where we want to make sure we're selecting the hard disk that we created with our VM instead of the optical drive. And it's going to ask you one more time if you're sure you want to do that. That's fine. And this is a really quick install as well. Now, we use these I've used these, I guess, in my job for sandbox environments, because you can start it up in Azure and AWS and GCP as well. So we'll spin up like an OpenSense VM and then attach it to some copies of a SQL database or a web application to do some testing and see how the firewall rules are affecting everything and to see what logs we're coming up with. Once it's finished installing, you should change your root password. Please change your default credentials for today. I'm not going to. I'm just going to press complete install for time. And it's going to automatically reboot. So once this actually shuts down, what I do is just go into my devices again and take out the ISO file just to make sure that it's not booting from it anymore. And I do another reset after I do that, just to make sure that we're not configuring and spending a bunch of time on a disk file that resets every time you shut the machine down. All right, so we are all good. We are booted from the hard drive now, and we can connect to it, the web GUI with the LAN interface. So let me just get a web browser open. And it's 192.168.1.1. And we haven't set up any certificates or anything on the firewall side, so you just have to press advanced and proceed. And the default credentials for your admin account is root and OpenSense. Oops. And here we go. So this is probably more familiar for anybody that has any firewall experience. It's a pretty typical web GUI. But we have our dashboard here that we can see some information, sysinfo, services that are running, gateway information, interface information, and you can also add in other widgets. So I personally like having CPU usage since it's a VM, and I like having my firewall log. I'll put system log in there, and then once I add other plugins and stuff, you can add widgets for those as well. And these are all customizable. You can drag things around so you have things where you like them. Anybody that works in cybersecurity knows how powerful your dashboards are, so it's good to have it set up for what you like. And here they make it really easy for you to change your default credentials, so there's no reason not to. We go down to system. One of the other first places you're going to go is this firmware tab. And under status, it's going to show you which version you're on. Since it's an open source platform, it's updating all of the time. So you want to make sure that you're always staying up to date. The documentation changes pretty frequently as well. So you just want to make sure that you're up to date so the documentation makes sense and matches. And under plugins, here's all the extra stuff that you can add on. I'm not going to have all the options here because I haven't updated this instance of it yet. But you can see things like different themes that you can add. So I have a dark mode on the main one that I use. There's intrusion prevention, intrusion detection plugins that you can download. There is antivirus like ClamAV. Or there's another IPS system called Suricata that's kind of popular. Not sure where that's at right now. And all of these plugins that you install, especially if it's something that you can interact with, will likely go down to the services tab here. And you'll just see an extra tab open for whatever plugins that you've installed. But moving on through the list, interfaces, you have your LAN interface, so you can change things here. I usually turn IPv6 off because nobody likes IPv6. You can see the assignments that you have. So this is another spot that you can double check the MAC address on your adapter to make sure that you have it set up correctly. Other overviews, diagnostics, and then under firewall, this is arguably probably where you spend most of your time. You can set up aliases. So if you have, you know, in production system, you have 100 hosts, you can just create aliases that represent groups of those hosts instead of having to type in all the individual IPs all the time when you're creating rules. So that's really nice. You can configure NAT. You have your different rules. So floating rules, LAN rules, WAN rules. You can do traffic shaping. You have all your log files here as well. And you can configure these to go to an external log server as well if you'd like. You can configure a VPN. And DHCP is here as well. So you can change the pool that you'd like to assign to hosts. Set up default DNS servers. And all of that good stuff. Intrusion detection. This one is kind of a higher learning curve. There's a lot of confusing things in the intrusion detection piece of OpenSense, but it's really powerful and it's fun to see how it actually acts with production applications. And you can change your network time. So if you want a different NTP server, you can do all that here. So there's a lot of stuff here. I encourage everybody that's interested in it just to download it and play with it. There's too much to do in, you know, even an hour masterclass. So yeah, there you go.
Cool stuff. Good job. Good, good. All right. Up next, we have a Jonathan White, DNA Center made by Cisco.
What's going on? You guys hear me?
Yep, I can hear you.
Awesome. Thanks, Jordan.
All right. No problem.
Started on this. Man, everyone's presentation has been really good so far. Hoping to keep it up to standard. you guys see the presentation?
Yep. Just like I was telling everybody else, make sure if you have any audio or anything like that, just to share with sound.
Okay. Got it.
All right. It's all yours.
Awesome. So let me up. All right. Sweet. Okay. So today I'll be going over the DNA Center. This device is really cool. It was created by Cisco not too long ago. Really great device. It's very Cisco proprietary, so that's a downfall, but overall, great device. So far for our agenda today, we'll be talking about the DNA Center. What is it? Why am I presenting this single device to everyone? We're going over the placement of the device as a cybersecurity perspective. We're going to be going over the business benefits. I like to just display that because not all businesses wants to pay thousands of dollars to one device. So I think it's important us in IT to kind of say, hey, this is what's important to the business. We're also going to be going over the network operations, how the DNA Center works through normal networking day-to-day tasks. Next is about wireless. DNA Center works with wireless, really helps it out. Again, with everything else, we're also going over security concepts as well with the DNA Center. So, overview of the DNA Center. This thing is a proprietary device, so it's really only going to be able to go with Cisco components. I'll get to that in a minute. There's a lot of slides that go over that. First thing is a powerful management system. So the system is able to manage all devices into one. So your Cisco routers, your switches, your ICE, your umbrella, all can be managed within one device. So it's really just a streamlined way to display all your information within one. This has AI and machine learning support. So what this is going to do is make recommendations on the things we talked about in the agenda. So this can be like your Wi-Fi network, but we'll get into that. Machine learning, what I mean by that is a baseline. So for the network, it'll set a baseline of how the network should create. And then after that, any anomalies will happen. Then it'll say, hey, there's a problem. Again, kind of what I explained already, streamlines complex network operations, and it overall just optimizes the IT infrastructure. So we're going to be getting into the DNA Center placement. Pay attention more towards the left diagram. As you can see, the DNA Center is more towards the top right. If you guys don't see it, you guys see my cursor, I hope. It's going to be right here. So this is usually, this placement is usually going to be with your ICE, which is the Cisco Policy Management, or I'm sorry, Security Policy Management. For Cisco, your Active Directory, your DNS or DHCP, it's the DNA Center is going to be right where those guys are because this device is able to access all the devices on the network. So it is quite critical we secure that. So we're going to go on to the next slide. Again, we're going to go over the business benefits. Again, I kind of already talked about this already. It does a lot of network optimization. This is going to streamline a lot of tasks that a lot of employees will spend probably like 45 minutes to an hour doing. I'll get to that in the network section. It has optimal end user support. So it really helps the end user with bandwidth issues, Wi-Fi issues. Again, I'll get into that. And it also has powerful AI integration. This lowers the how employees think because DNA Center will recommend different things on different situations. So it's really awesome, really cool. And this picture right here is one of the AI recommendations. It's basically showing you the health of application or a network. It just basically goes overall like what could be better for the network, what could be better. So we're going to move over to the network operations. This is going to be all the networking DNA Center has. So your routers, your switches, your core switches will all be plugged in. All that data will be connected to the DNA Center. Now the DNA Center will pop up this diagram. This is within DNA Center. It'll pop up with maybe clients, so phones, routers, and switches. It'll all come up that on this diagram. You don't have to go into like Visio and create a diagram. As my previous job, I was a network engineer, and this is what we did a lot of the time, just to have that. But it's nice to just simply just plug something in and just have it right there. It has automation discovery. So what this means is packets will be sent out via the DNA Center saying, hey, is there any of the Cisco devices that wants to connect? And once a Cisco, let's say like a Catalyst 6500 comes in and plugs in, then DNA Center will see that, put it on the diagram. It's got policy-driven configuration. So if you have an access control list, you want to put in like a configuration for some reason for all the core switches, routers, you can put that within one single click, within one single command. That's it. That's all you have to do. You don't have to log into every single switch. When you're working on a more heavier IT infrastructure where you have lots of routers and switches, it really streamlines that process. It has compliance up to date. So basically, it ensures all your components are up to date no matter what. It'll say like it'll say on the DNA Center, hey, we noticed that your routers are out of date. Please update it. It also has third-party ecosystem integration. That's like your Splunk. It has integrated Splunk with this. We already talked about this, visibility health. It has health into your architecture, making sure that there is no problems within your network. A great example of this would be throttle down. So there may be an issue with a switch that might need to just be restarted, but it could be slowing users down. Your DNA Center will come up and say, hey, this switch might be acting up. Can we please do something with this? Basically, it'll give you a list of stuff to do. Goes on to my next thing, faster troubleshooting. That's one of the things. It has this diagram. Guided workflows. Exactly what I kind of just mentioned. DNA Center has a guided workflow that'll help assist you if something may go down, if something else may happen on the network just overall. Again, AI ops, machine learning algorithms. This basically is setting a baseline for your whole network of what should be going through and whatnot. And if there's any issues or anomalies, it'll pop up and say, hey, this is weird. So great, awesome tool for their networking team. So we're going to move on to the wireless section. I really love this design. This is one of the DNA Center uses. Cisco creates a proprietary device called the Wireless LAN Controller that runs all the APs. That device connects to the DNA Center. It does cost a lot to make this move, but it is super helpful. I worked with the Wireless LAN Controller a lot as a network engineer, and let me tell you, it's better to see everything on diagrams, stuff like I'm showing you on the pictures, than it is just reading words and debugging and just doing all that just numbers game. I'd rather just look at it straight from here. It's all streamlined. We're going to be going over AP performance, and what I mean by AP is access points, so just Wi-Fi in general, the Wi-Fi devices, AP monitoring, AP AI. So Wi-Fi signals, they have a problem nowadays because there's more and more APs getting put up in businesses, schools. I also used to work and help out schools for IT. And so what a lot of schools have is they have access points in every single classroom, and they don't care where they put them. They'll put them in the very corner of the room. They'll put them in the very middle of the room, which is great. So it's just lots of errors on that part. And just going over this diagram of showing the performance is exactly what we need, because APs, they have this thing where they need to be on channels. And if two APs that are right next to each other are on the same channel, they'll both transmit each other and cause a lot of errors. And those errors will make their utilization go up. So they'll be at 100% for just no reason. So no clients in that certain classroom will not be able to do or perform their work. So instead, they got to be on different channels. And this is also what I mean by actionable insights, top left right here. There could be insights on your Wi-Fi saying, hey, DNA Center is saying, hey, this is the issue. What can we do to solve this? And I'll kind of show you. Again, performance, you got your summary right there of what you have. Now, I wanted to go on the bottom left screen too. The potentially poor client experience. This is what I mean about the topics I already talked about with end user experience. This is super important, in my opinion. It's just saying, hey, this client may be having issues. Because what happens is at my job, we used to have to always constantly ask the IT staff, hey, is your client having issues? And it was a constant daily task that we had to do. Now, with this involved, it's going to really help that user support. So we don't have to keep asking. It gets annoying when we have to keep asking them this. All right, let's move on. I don't want to run out of time here. We're going to go over to Wi-Fi again, but this time we're going to look at the heat maps. Heat maps are basically Wi-Fi transmissions that's went onto a map. The DNA Center does this automatically. As you can see, the little green areas where the green on the left-hand side, the wireless 2D map, those are going to be your APs. What makes this really nice is that you can decide what placements you should be doing. And now DNA Center is also creating wireless 3D maps. So you can map out your whole like classroom, your school district, or business within the DNA Center. And then now you can make smart adjustments instead of wasting money on multiple APs or slowing down clients with just this map alone. This is an awesome thing. I also created diagrams for this to help clients get better service, and it was a pain. So next, we're going to move into one of our last things is going to be the DNA security. I took a look on this. There is some options with DNA security. Again, with ICE, we're able to profile all the endpoint users. We're able to set a baseline saying, hey, this user connects to the web. This user needs it for a share drive, for example. And if a user does something that's very like a weird behavior, then DNA Center will bring it up and saying, hey, this is kind of weird. Let's investigate this. This also has Cisco or integrated Cisco securities. This is going to be stuff like your umbrella. It's also another one, the compliance. That's going to be like making sure your devices are up to date for security reasons, any vulnerabilities that may be happening. And with that being said, we reached the end. Does anyone have any questions for me?
Yeah, I have a couple.
Yeah, what's up, Robert?
I just wanted to double check the map that you showed like two slides ago. That's automatically drawn, or did you know whomever's managing the network have to tell it where these access points are and what the rooms look like?
So that's the thing that I was trying to research this as well, Robert. I don't have access to the DNA Center, or else I'd look into it more. I've been researching this, and it does its job. It kind of maps out because it can detect barriers and whatnot, but I don't think it does. I think you're gonna have to create the diagram yourself of like what your foundation is, everything, but it'll still create the heat map of everything. So really, okay. You can just create the whole diagram based on where the placement of the APs are, and just kind of build from there.
All right. So building on that, is there any way to automate some of the kind of mundane tasks, such as you were mentioning the APs being on the same channel? If you're telling it or it knows that the two are right next to each other, will it automate the task of switching channels?
Yes, sir.
Okay, cool. So
this actually, the DNA Center does actually not do that. It does not automate that. The remember what I said on the wireless LAN controller? That that operates all the access points. That's the one that that you can set it to automatically do that. But sometimes there might be bugs in the system where you have to statically assign it a channel. But more than likely, it's going to automatically assign, saying, "Hey, you need to move to this channel." So if there's two APs right next to each other, one's at 1, one's at 11. So the how the channels work. I'm sorry, I didn't explain this. Is it's 1 through 11, right? 1 through 11. And they want to be as far away as possible. So 1 AP could be at 11, 1 AP can be at 1. If another AP comes in, that one's going to be at 6. It just starts creating this chaos of every AP fighting for a channel that has the best utilization. And that's where that's why this heat map is so important. Like, I wish I had this instead of driving 2 hours to a client to run scans everywhere, you know?
Yeah. I'm sure it helps people decide whether they're going to go with the omnidirectional or bidirectional, whatever sort of antennas for them as well. Okay.
Exactly.
That's cool.
Yes, sir. Yep. So, any more questions for me? Nope. Okay. That is my presentation. Thank you guys for listening in. Here's my references. It's all from Cisco. So thank you guys.
Cool stuff. Good job. Up next, we got Rob C. DeBaca for ransomware.
Hello, everybody. Wow. Everybody went so in-depth with theirs. I hope everybody's still awake after mine. All right. And here we go. You guys should be able to see the presentation now. Is that correct?
Yep, we can see it.
Yep.
Outstanding. Rather than scaring the heck out of everybody with a live demo of what ransomware looks like, I want to take a step back and let people know what we can do to prevent it and what we can do after the fact if our mitigation doesn't work, right? So let's start off with what exactly ransomware is. So we're going to be going over what ransomware is, what kind of types of ransomware there are, some recent examples of them, mitigation, and incident response and disaster recovery, right, if all else fails. So first off, ransomware is a type of malicious software. It's designed to block access to a computer system, essentially until a sum of money is paid, right? This usually involves encrypting data, definitely without consent and without the provision of the necessary keys to decrypt that data. It's going to involve communication with the victim, instructions on how much to pay, and how to complete the transaction. Right, a lot of these transactions are not going to want like a paper trail, so cryptocurrency or like gift cards is a fairly common form of currency for these types of transactions. May also involve other malware. This can include screen capture, camera hijacking, key loggers. Data leaks, they can gain access to your data. So any number of things can really come up and cause issues and can be bundled along with the malware while the main component of it is ransomware. So there's different types, right? But basically breaks down to two, and then most of them are kind of a combination of those two. So the first type is a locker, right? This is the type of ransomware that's going to lock down functionality. It's going to prevent you from leaving either a single window, or it'll lock down like just portions of your operating system that can make it harder to remove the malware to begin with, or it can make it so it's nearly impossible to use your device for anything other than directions on how to pay them, right? There's also crypto, right? This type encrypts the victim's personal data in an attempt to ransom it back to them. So that's going to be, I mean, everybody's heard of, I believe, WannaCry, yeah. Where they'll encrypt your own data, not giving you the key until you pay them the money, right? And then, like I said, most of them kind of include both of these. And so they'll encrypt your data so you don't have access to it, and they'll block other parts of your operating system, preventing you from removing where they installed the malware there. Some recent examples of this is going to be Ryuk. Beyond encrypting the data, this malware also blocked access to Windows recovery, right? So even if you were diligent about backups and you backed up on your own device, this particular type of malware would prevent you from being able to restore your data unless you had backed it up externally on a separate device, right? Jigsaw, this one was semi-entertaining to read about. So it had some imagery from the movie Saw, the character Jigsaw, right? Hence the name. But in order to reduce the time to action for the victim, increase their likelihood to pay and pay quickly, the malware would start deleting data on its schedule. So as the hours start ticking by, more and more of your data is getting removed. So that's that can get kind of scary there. And then there's also GanCrab. This malware made claims of hacking the victim's webcam and having unsavory footage it would reveal to the internet if the attacker's demands were not met. This one also had in the screen that it was showing to its victims, it was an image of them on their own webcam, showing that the malware at least had access to the webcam after the fact, and thus implying that it had access to the webcam prior as well. So we've heard kind of what it does and what can happen, right? Let's go over how to prevent it. The number one vector for this is going to be the end user, right? So most of these prevention steps are going to be hinged around the end user not installing it in the first place, right? So there's the rule of least privilege. In a professional environment, you want to reduce user access to only what is necessary to do their job. You also want to back up all mission critical data. That data should be backed up externally to separate devices, right? So a backup for each endpoint, and then each server should have a separate backup repository as well. Of course, keeping your anti-malware up to date and installed and turned on, right? This can be this can obviously be used personally as well, but in a professional environment, you'll want to use a variety of different anti-malware technologies. Things that are going to scour packets as they're incoming, sandbox things that look questionable, look for anomalies, and of course, signature-based as well, right? And then training, right? The main vector for installing malware is user error. So you want to train all of your employees and all the people in your household. Don't click suspicious links. For me, I have to tell my parents and grandparents a couple times a week, don't click that, don't respond to that text. It gets old, but you got to keep reminding people because not everybody's in this field with us. And so what do you do if you, when somebody inevitably clicks on that link and then calls you, right? The first thing you want to do is you want to identify the threat, right? You want to ensure that you know exactly what it is, where it came from. And a lot of times that'll tell you where it ended up on the system, whether it's in your if it's in your root files or if it's in your system 32 files, depending on what OS you're on, what have you. You want to know where it is. and when it got there, if possible, right? The time of the incident is going to be really important for what, if you are diligent with your backups, right? If it's not super critical information that you've, you know, made or created in the past, you know, since your last backup, you can just restore as long as you know when it was installed, restore to the nearest clean backup, and then work from there. Especially in a professional environment where time is money, you want to go to the nearest clean backup or clean install, right? And then you want to find that file if you can in the subsequent archives or backups, and clean it out of there, and then you may be able to even get a more recent recovery snapshot to recover to doing it that way, right? You're going to want to execute that recovery once you've identified the closest point to which you can. Once again, this is kind of focused towards a professional environment. The longer you wait to get yourself up and running, the more money the organization is going to lose. So you want to get it up and running as fast as possible. And then you want to do a thorough analysis. You want to provide assurance that the recovery that you did restore to doesn't include that malware. You want to help eliminate, you also want to analyze where it came from, how it got in, and help eliminate that threat vector, right? If that was a downloaded, link, you really need to focus more on training your employees, right? If it was, you know, a floppy drive or somebody's using, you know, unapproved cloud services, anything of that nature, you want to be able to set the rules to enforce what you need to do to prevent this from happening again. And that's the end of my presentation. Does anybody have any questions about that? Hearing none, I'll pass it back to you, Jordan.
Sweet. Good job.
Thank you.
All right. No problem. Up next, we got Jimmy Monreal for IoT Business Application, Internet of Things.
Hey, good evening, everybody. I'm just going to share my screen. Can you see it?
I don't see anything yet.
Give me one second.
Oh, there we go. You're ready to go. Just make sure you do click share with audio. That's all.
All right, there's no audio on the video. All right. Ready to go. Hopefully everybody's still awake. I know it's kind of late, and thank you for hanging in there with us. Good evening, everybody. My name is Jimmy, and today my masterclass presentation will be on the Internet of Things business applications. So I want to start with, what is IoT? The Internet of Things, or IoT, is a network of technologies that have sensors, operating systems, and other technologies, and is able to communicate. It is beyond smartphones, computers, and tablets. The spectrum of IoT devices is wide and diverse. They range from autonomous vehicles to wearables to rat sensors. Examples in your home may be the Nest thermostat, smart speakers, your wearables such as Apple Watches. IoT devices are estimated to hit 14.4 billion in 2023 and a projected 27 billion by 2025. As of 2022, the average U.S. household has 22 connected IoT devices. So how does it work? It starts with the sensors. The sensors send data to a gateway over a low-power LoRa network that works in-building, outside, and even in parking garages. The gateway then transmits over the network or Ethernet, depending on the gateway. This gateway then sends data to the server. Here, management can access the information, identify trends, see historical alerts, and process reports, all from sensors that are virtually anywhere through a web-based portal. As it stands right now, there are six main categories of IoT wireless tech. First is low-power wide area networks, which provide long-range communication on small, cheap batteries that last years. They aim to support large-scale IoT networks over more significant sites. Next, cellular, such as 3G, 4G, and 5G, which are phone networks needed for calls, internet access, video streaming, and multiple applications. However, they are expensive to run and very power intensive. Third is Zigbee, which is mesh protocols, which are and other mesh protocols that are short range wireless and low power standard using sensor data nodes. These boast high data rates, but isn't as power efficient as low power wide area networks. Fourth, Bluetooth. Bluetooth technology is short range communication and which enables data exchange across multiple nodes. A low-power version was invented for small consumer IoT applications. Fifth, Wi-Fi. Not as common in the IoT space due to problems with scalability, coverage, and power use. And finally, sixth is RFID, known as radio frequency identification, radio waves which transmit data from a tag to your reader at a short distance. They're usually used for logistics and retail. So what are the impacts of IoT? As it stands, relying on manual monitoring can be costly to a business, has potential for human error, and may not alert management to issues in time to avoid costly fines or damage. IoT solutions can impact metrics such as inventory loss, equipment damage, costly downtime, operational inefficiencies, safety hazards, regulatory fines, and reputation damage. Let's talk about business applications. I want to start with the energy sector for IoT, and I thought this was really neat. But I'm going to start with a hot mess fact, which 1 pound of concrete, the production of 1 pound of concrete emits 0.93 pounds of CO2 emission, which is incredibly not sustainable, especially given, you know, the climate that we live or the environmental restrictions that we should be implementing moving forward. In California, a renewable energy company known as Heliogen uses mirrors in the Mojave Desert that are embedded with IoT sensors and machine learning capabilities to optimize solar panel placement. The levels of heat generated from their systems have reached heights of 1800 degrees. The resulting high energy concentration could be a massive shift for heavy industrial processes. It would replace their current high carbon footprint process with a far more sustainable form in solar. This can help replace heavily polluting fuels and by making it possible to capture emissions that are a separate part of the process of making cement. Next is agriculture. The application of IoT in agriculture is as simple as watering crops. IoT sensors can automate watering systems whenever solar levels drop. The way this system works is in four easy steps. One, sensors and actuators monitor solar levels. Two, the changes are communicated using MQTT or HTTP communication protocols to the IoT gateway. Three, the gateway receives and sends information to the cloud using Wi-Fi. And four, once the drop in moisture is communicated, the sprinkler system turns on. The info stored on the cloud can be used for analysis, which is probably the largest benefit. The timing of the activation, the rate at which moisture drops, and the amount of water used can all be monitored and analyzed. This is an example of a great sensor that can be used. It is pretty much an all-in-one solution. It offers monitoring of CO2 levels, temperature and humidity, total volatile organic compounds, motion detection, barometric pressure, and light sensors as well. Sorry, this thing's not changing. There we go. Now retail. In retail, the applications are numerous. I picked the four that stood out to me the most that are interesting, and this is going back to that rat trap. Rat trap sensors can help eliminate the expenses of having to hire someone and
it's a game.
Monitor.
It sure is.
It's pretty funny. Indoor tampering. So this will be able to monitor priceless equipment, jewelry, stuff like that. Stuff that shouldn't be moved will be pretty much monitored 24/7. There's also door monitoring, which helps in retail for analytics. So you'll be able to track the foot traffic, footsteps that are of the client bases that are coming in, going out. You could set it up to capture anytime someone walks in, the door's open. You could set it for, you know, 10-minute intervals at a time as well, stuff like that. And finally, perimeter monitoring for security purposes, obviously. In the event that there's a break-in or if there is an accident that happens, you'll be alerted instantaneously. Temperature monitoring is another example of the application of for retail. Pharmacies, restaurants, convenience stores, grocery stores all have a need to ensure items are stored at the right temperatures. In some cases, it may be a regulatory requirement to ensure food or other perishables are kept at the right temperature. In all cases, inventory can be a total expensive loss if temperature not maintained. And worse, if it's not discovered the temperatures are not maintained and the items are later sold, that could result in a public health issue, lawsuit, reputation damage, or worse, deaths. The next sector or vertical is going to be hospitality. I want to start with two facts. Over 14% of sexual harassment charges filed in the past decade occurred in the accommodation or food room service industries. More than 25% occurred in industries dominated by service sector workers. It's an unfortunate stat, but something that IoT can definitely help with. And the example I have here is a push emergency system. It's a one button, one click. But what this does is workers can carry a lanyard and press a button if they need to. The designated responders get an immediate alert and location of the employee. The system tracks the employee if they're on the move. This works anywhere within range of the gateway, in building, outside, even in parking garage. But due to the nature of the system, the solution is something that has to be professionally installed by a vendor. And this is an example of how it works. So similar to what I described earlier, where the sensors send the data to the gateway transmits to the network, and from the gate or using the gateway, and then it is sent to the server. The main difference is the implementation of Bluetooth nodes, which will be able to provide a more accurate second-by-second location of the wherever this thing is the signal is coming from. Another aspect for hospitality is indoor air quality. And everybody knows where I'm going with this, but we just got out of a pandemic. And I want to leave with this fact. Most people spend about 90% of their time indoors, where pollutants can be twice to five times and occasionally 100 times higher than outdoor levels. And to relate to the application, indoor air quality inside schools and workplaces impacts not only comfort, but also health. Symptoms such as headache, fatigue, trouble concentrating, and illness may accompany poor air quality due to improper ventilation, lack of temperature control, and extreme high or extremely low humidity. What about IoT and manufacturing? We're currently in Industry 4.0, but in order to understand and appreciate what Industry 4.0 is, let's start from the beginning. The first industrial revolution came about with the creation of the steam engine in 1784. Industry 2.0 came in the late 1800s, thanks to the introduction of the assembly line and electrical energy. Fun fact, Henry Ford is credited with the creation of the now famous assembly line, the same one that we use from automotive production to McDonald's assembly line for their burgers. The third iteration came with the implementation of computers, electricity, and other technology that helped automate manufacturing. Industry 4.0 refers to our current era, which utilizes automation, computers, and electronics on another level. In this iteration, IoT, machine learning, and big data elevate the ecosystems in which they are implemented. And the numbers don't lie. There's been a significant impact in this industry, namely the reduction of costs, obviously operational efficiencies being improved, and with safety seeing a significant boost at 23% year over year. Next is logistics. From 2020 to 2021, U.S. businesses' transportation costs have risen 22%, totaling $1.85 trillion. In the same period, the cost of storing inventory increased 26%. Now, as the world shrinks and everything's being transported, how do you localize it? How do you locate or track your packages, your inventory? Well, IoT provides a solution in the form of asset tracking. This is an example of an asset tracking sensor. It is fully autonomous, so you don't have to connect, to Wi-Fi or anything hardwired. The sensors provide secure, accurate location of the environment and as well as physical conditions of the device. The impact, obviously, for logistics is huge. It prevents asset loss, theft, or damage using on-demand access to real-time location, environment, and physical condition data. You're able to track your assets virtually anywhere, so you can maximize utilization and minimize downtime. The solution integrates smoothly into your operations, which is an easy-to-use web and mobile-based app and self-installation with self-installation options. Now, these solutions sound pretty awesome, but there are concerns. A few of the main concerns at a high level are going to be visibility.
Is it just like super bright, like the entire world's flashbanging you?
All right, mic check. IoT security challenges, visibility, security integration, open source vulnerabilities, immense data volume, poor testing, unpatched vulnerabilities, vulnerable APIs, and weak passwords.
Jimmy, we can't hear you anymore.
Oh man, I muted myself. Was that okay, last slide?
We all
slide?
Do it.
All right, so that last slide, you didn't hear anything, or since when?
Just the second to last one.
Man, that was the funny one.
Oh well, go back and do it.
All right, so this one. All right, so trouble brewing in 2015. Trouble began to brew for users of a smart kettle in London. It had virtually no security in place, leaving unsuspecting tea lovers vulnerable. The hacker claims he could sit outside a victim's place with a directional antenna pointed at their house, knock the kettle off their access point, make it connect to himself, send to commands, and the kettle would disclose the victim's Wi-Fi password. So this is a great example of just rushing to production and not fully testing or identifying the proper security protocols that need to be in place. So how do we address this? It is important to be as meticulous as possible when it comes to managing IoT security. The strategy must be consistent, must consist of a variety of tactics and tools while simultaneously factoring in relational systems such as networks. It can be broken down to three general keys: for a good, robust security solution. One, learn. Use solutions in place that provide clarity of the network to assess the risk profiles for each group of IoT devices. Provide education for all stakeholders along with best practices. Two, protect. Create, implement, enforce, and reevaluate IoT security policies. Three, segment. Implement segmentation for IoT systems based on their risk profile. And that concludes my presentation.
Cool stuff, man.
Thank you.
All right. Last but not least, we have Cassidy Sanchez with Ethical Hacking with Wireshark. Cassidy, are you muted by chance? Oh, sorry. I didn't realize you had a pre-recorded presentation. Okay. Cassidy, just make sure that you, when you shared your screen, make sure you click on where it says share. There'll be a drop down, say include computer sound. Make sure you click on that too, just in case. I don't know if your sound starts right away on the video, but I just want to make sure. There we go.
Perfect. Hello, everyone. My name is Cassidy Sanchez, and today I will be talking to you about the ethical hacking with Wireshark. I do want to apologize. I am sick, and I have a lot of stuff running on here, so if there's any delays in the feedback, I do apologize beforehand. Okay, so to get started, for my project, I wanted to simulate how Wireshark is used to sniff out weaknesses in the system. Companies use Wireshark to help protect their network and to help troubleshoot issues. However, it can be used for malicious intent. So during this demonstration, I will show you how Wireshark can tap into a voice over IP call and other ways it can be used. Hope you enjoy. So first, I wanted to go over the applications I used to put this presentation together. I used Wireshark, Zoiper, VoIPMS, Virtual Machine, and GNS3. Okay, so Virtual Machine, let me go ahead and pull this up. This is my Virtual Machine. Virtual Machines are a computing resource of software. Instead of a physical computer running hardware, it's a virtual machine, a virtualization of a computer. With all of the functions of a physical computer, and it implements hardware and software. As you can see, I'm running Oracle Virtual Machine Box with Ubuntu Linux 22.10 version. All this stuff is free, easy to download. If you've definitely done it before, there'll be links at the end of the presentation of where I got all these. Okay, next. It is Zoiper 5. Zoiper is free. It's a SIP protocol. It is a soft phone. Anybody who's ever worked remotely is probably very familiar with the soft phone. And it uses the voice over internet protocol. So VoIP is where you can call someone over the internet. If you've ever used WhatsApp or Messenger, you've used VoIP before. So yeah, SIP stands for the Season Terminating Communications, and it's a networking protocol that enables the VoIP. Okay, to enable my Zwiper. Let me go ahead and pull this up over here. I forgot to show you guys. I'm hitting the wrong buttons over here. Okay. This is my phone. Obviously, it works. This is Zwiper 5. Don't worry. These phone numbers have probably already been, if they're not already blurred out, if I wasn't able to do that, then they've already been deactivated. So if you call them now, nothing will happen. That's why I pre-recorded. Okay, so moving on. The VoIPM S, it's not free, very cheap though. I think the total, how many times I had to call myself to practice, probably cost me about maybe $20, which it was okay. It was cool to mess with it and figure it out. I've never tried to call myself before. Wire shirt and all that, still kind of fairly new to me, but ethical hacking has always interested me. So that's why I decided to do my project on it. So VoIPM S, let me go ahead and bring this over here. Okay, this is what it looks like. You can create sub accounts. This is where I went to create multiple phones so I could have one on my virtual machine and have one actually on my computer itself as well. Okay. over here, if we go to advanced, you can see it uses the SIP protocol. It is not encrypted. So I can go ahead and minimize this. Okay. Like I said, it's a cloud-based VoIP provider. Security features cover it. Okay, next. Okay, and Wireshark. So Wireshark is used to the GNS3, but for this presentation, for the sake of lacking and my sanity, I will just be doing it through the regular application. So this is Wireshark here. I'm going to let this load while I give you a little bit more information about it. So Wireshark can be used in GNS3, but it's its own application, like I said. It's a real-time network packet analyzer. Wireshark can capture and view suspicious data in your network and can help troubleshoot network issues. Even though Wireshark can be used for malicious intent, it is still very useful for cybersecurity. Okay, whenever you first open Wireshark, we're going to see here, my virtual machines are running. I have to wait for that to load. While this is loading up, I'll go ahead and display my virtual networks that I have here. You can see I have the virtual networks. They're still loading. Okay, we'll go ahead and go into here and I'll display this other one first then. Okay, so as you can see, I opened it, Wireshark's running. And this first box here is called the packet list, where packets are coming in. Everything that's going through my network is coming in. You can see it right here. You can refresh it, stop it, restart it to choose a different one, different network path, such as Wi-Fi or whatever. But my laptop is set up through hardwired right now. You can see the source IP address, what time they come in, the destination IP address, what protocols it's using, the length and information about it, these packets. Okay, you have the filter here. I can filter the protocols to see, say if I want to see something more specific like HTTP, I can stop it, type in HTTP. Okay, so for this, let me go ahead and say, say I want to see sites that are being used on my network. Say over here, you know, if you click on one and you look, it's not really going to show you the name of these websites or anything. It's just going to show you IP addresses. And for average eyes, we're not going to look at this. So I'm going to open up my internet. If it decides to ever open. Sorry, this is what I was talking about. I'll pull this over here while I look this up real quick. So let's look up something like, so that's probably not gonna come up. It's insecure, right? So We got some Cisco and misspelled it, obviously. It's not secure. It's up. It's on my network. We're going to stop this packet filter. We're going to go up here and we're going to search for HTTP because obviously we know HTTPS is a secure one. HTTP isn't. We're going to host. We're going to look for this. So we see some suspicious stuff in here, right? So let's click on this HTTP. We're going to look. Again, it doesn't show us the name of this website, but we know it's probably not secure. So let's go into statistics, HTTP, load distributor. And now we can see exactly what website I went to right there. So that's how you check it out. I've also connected to Ubuntu. There's some other stuff in here. Okay, so that's how you check that out. It does show sorry. Oh, this thing's annoying. Okay, so a little bit more about Wireshark. This one is called the packet bytes. Just real quick, it's the detailed, this is the detailed packet. You click these, it'll highlight what exactly, if you see down here, it's highlighting more. This is the hexadecimal and it just displays more in detail what exactly we're looking for in here, just in case. Not really used that often. Okay, so let me go back here. And did I completely skip over a whole? It's down because it was causing major lagging. And if I open it again, it's just extremely slow. So we're going to keep that off. I've already have my Wireshark open and running between the Ubuntu and my Switch to capture the VoIP call. So we're not going to stop that. This is just like more of a visual representation of what's going on. So I've already linked my Ubuntu's together. If you look in back into my virtual box right here, how I did that was I went in here, went to settings, took a lot of research, but I had specific adapters to connect these two together, fill in the IP addresses. So whenever you put any virtual machine on here, including the GNS3, Oracle or any virtual box or machine configures it to the same IP address. So I had to go in here and change these. And I went in there and obviously I went in there and changed them. And by giving them their separate networks, creating a virtual network infrastructure, it allowed me to do that. Okay. So let's go into this wiretap real quick. So let me go ahead and bring over my phones. This is the one on my computer. This is my virtual machine. Okay, and you can see these two are different. Like I said, these numbers do not work. Please do not call me. Okay, they're different, Cast36, VoIP. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to call my phone. Let's go ahead and pull up Wireshark Pro here and start this capturing first before I forget. Take off this filter. Okay, so I'm making the call and I'm just going to apologize for the feedback. I'll go ahead and call. If it picks up, sometimes I might have to do it 2 or 3 times just to see it. Sometimes if it doesn't call, it's when I have to call the other one. So let's try this one. It's calling, so it should register to hear now. Unless I called myself. other one I called myself. There we go. Took it 2 times, but I got it. Okay, so I'm going to answer it. Okay, you can hear the feedback. And I'm talking to myself. But we want a good long audio call. Because it's going to break up. Because it's on one mic. All right, goodbye. All right, so that call's over. And we can get these out of the way now. That was another 5 cents. Okay, so let's get this back up here real quick. I'm going to stop it. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to look for real-time protocols. Okay. You can see there's a few up here. And we can see a lot of stuff going on here. So let's, what we're going to do is we're going to decode it first. As RDP. Sorry, RTP. Okay, I decode it. Let's click one. Now let's see if there was any telephony calls. Had to exit the folder. So you can see we tried to call multiple times and it didn't work the first time, but then that's why I wanted to make it long. So we can see both indication calls. If we skip one, let's hit play. Okay, that one was horrible. We might try the phone call again. Let's see what this one says. There we go. This one's better.
You can hear the feedback. And I'm talking to myself. I'm going to have a good call. Because it's going to break up.
Okay. So that's good. That one we could hear a lot better. So we shouldn't have to make another call. So what's going on here? Now, remember, Wireshark is an application monitoring my network. Wireshark does this by recording each wavelength. So right here, if you look, you see this G711. This G711 is what we call a codec for encoding an analog voice. So an analog voice is a waveform. So when I speak, the G7 picks up on wave sounds and records them by binary forms, ones and zeros. Codec, that's the purpose of the decoder. When I went in and decoded it, that makes sense to the binary RTP right there. Right? Okay. So now, so we can hear and see the exact calls between both ends or more than one at a time. We're going to go back to the telephony real quick. And this time we're going to go down to real-time protocol, play the streams. And now we have the streams here. And if I click all of these and I play, we have all three streams.
You can hear the feedback. And I'm talking to myself. I'm going to want a good call.
And obviously, if that was a better call, you would have heard each line. So what it's doing here is each call has its own stream. If I call you, my voice going to you is one way, and then you coming to me, talking to me is another way. So that's why there's so many in here. And if we just click one, you'll be able to hear it a lot easier, a lot better. That was a bad one. Let's see this one. So you pretty much can hear them individually.
You can hear the feedback. And I'm talking to myself. You probably want a good call. Because it's going to break up. There's no one mic. Say goodbye.
Okay. So that's that. Now, what about if I call my personal phone with an unencrypted soft phone? My personal phone is on the Wi-Fi. However, it is encrypted and using an active phone service provider. Let's see if Wireshark can listen in to this phone call. Okay, so we're going to start a new segment. I'm going to go down here. I'm going to bring over my soft phone. I'm going to blur out my phone number so no one calls me. And I'm going to call my cell phone. Hello?
Hello?
This is my cell phone.
This is my cell phone.
And a lot of feedback. So I'm going to hang up. Okay, so now that that's done, I'm going to move this out of the way. I'm going to stop this filter. We have a lot of text, acknowledgments, sequence numbers. Just trying to figure out what's going on. So for this, let's go ahead and... the most recent RTP packets. We're going to decode them. Although it should already be done, we'll go ahead and do it again. Let's do one of these, go up to telephony. Now we're just going to go down to the streams. And remember, this is a new... I closed out the other one, so this is a new stream.
Hello?
Hello? This is my phone. Okay. So let's try these a little bit better. Let's see if we can... So though it did record, but due to my soft voice and a lot of frequency, a lot of waves coming in before, it was kind of bad to hear it, but you get the concept. You can still, even though, as long as one side's unencrypted, anyone can listen in on these calls and see where they're coming from and exactly. Definitely would be good for any investigations, listening in on calls. And Wireshark has many other uses, such as decrypting passwords and usernames, ethically, of course. So I hope y'all enjoyed. Thank you. Hello, everyone. My name is Cassidy Sanchez.
Cool stuff. Good job. All right. Well, I think that concludes our masterclass. I want to thank everybody for their presentations. Everybody did an excellent job. Make sure you guys don't forget to clock out. And I don't have anything else unless Marjorie or Marcia have anything. Very good. Well, if nobody else has anything else, no questions, I think we're good to call it a night. Have a good night, everyone.